Our Bible readings today come from Genesis and from Matthew, and our introduction to the first reading. We continue the story of Jacob, who last week we heard had extorted his brother Esau, birthright, for a bowl of soup or stew. The story continued to devolve from there, with his mother Rebekah's help. Remember, Rebekah favoured Jacob, while Isaac favoured Esau. Jacob next intentionally deceived his own father to receive the blessing Isaac intended for elder son Esau. As a result, Esau planned to kill his brother, and Jacob fled for his life. His scheming to obtain birthright and blessing left him homeless and on the run. But the irony is, the destination of his flight was Haran, the place where his grandparents, Abraham and Sarah, first demonstrated trust in God by setting out on their promise-driven journey. For Jacob, it is as if he too needs to go back to the beginning and learn what it means not to scheme, but to trust. Our reading in the Old Testament is Genesis chapter 28, verses 10 to 19. Jacob's dream at Bethel. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran. He came to a certain place and stayed there for the night, because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and laid down in that place. And he dreamed that there was a ladder set up on the earth, the top of it reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the Lord stood beside him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. And your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, and to the north and to the south. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and in your offspring. Know that I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob woke from his sleep and said, Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So Jacob rose early in the morning, and he took the stone that he had put under his head, and he set it up for a pillar, and poured oil on the top of it. He called that place Bethel. Our New Testament reading from Matthew, the introduction. The parables of the weeds appears only in Matthew's Gospel. He first tells the parable, and then, after a space, has Jesus give the interpretation privately to the disciples. The parable of the weeds may have functioned in various ways at different stages of its transmission. Some elements which receive emphasis in the parable receive almost no emphasis in the interpretation. The interpretation is unlikely to have accompanied the parable from the beginning, but it testifies to creative use of the story. The imagery echoes John the Baptist's preaching and may be an attempt to explain the existence of evil. So Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 to 30 and 36 to 43. The parable of the weeds among the wheat. He put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who has sowed good seed in the field. But while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat, and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, "Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these seeds come from?" He answered, "An enemy has done this." The slaves said to him, "Then do you want us to go and gather them?" But he replied, "No, for in gathering the weeds you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time I will tell the reapers, 'Collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Jesus explains the parable of the weeds. Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples approached him, saying, "Explain to us the parables of the weeds of the field." He answered, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Let anyone with ears listen." And this is the word of God. Thanks be to God.
We'd had a family celebration at our place. My children were probably around primary school age, and they were helping me clear up afterwards with various degrees of enthusiasm and reluctance, as children do. I'd started washing the dishes and I watched them clearing the plates off the table. I grab a plate and walk over to the side, or they'd hold it and swing it round like that, and the crumbs would shower off across the carpet. Now, we had a dog, Jesse, who was a very enthusiastic cleaner-upper of crumbs, but nevertheless, I was getting a little bit cheesed off by the way they were doing the job. So I grabbed a plate and I said to them, "This is the way you carry a plate. A plate is designed to catch crumbs and other things, and you carry it like this so it doesn't fall off. I don't want to see you doing this or this." And with that, the plate flew gracefully out of my hand and hit the window with a loud bang. Now, you may appreciate that my children remember that day very well. They don't remember it as the day when they learnt how to carry plates. They remember it as the day Mum threw a plate at the window. Can't it be frustrating to tell a story and to have someone miss the main point? To be telling something to someone about something that happened to someone, something very excited, and they get caught up in some insignificant detail that you probably just added to fill out the story. "Oh, are you sure it was a Camry? Because I thought Tim and Jane sold their Camry last year." Well, no, the point of the story was about what was happening to Tim and Jane when they drove in whatever sort of car it was. It can be frustrating to have people miss the point of what you're saying and get caught up on something else. I think this is what seems to happen with this parable of the wheat and the weeds. It is a story that seems to have been used for various purposes along the way. And after all, that is one of the things about parables. There is no definitive, and the moral of the story is. But somewhere in the telling and the retelling, in the community of people who helped shape Matthew's gospel, someone has felt the need to make a definitive statement, not only about the moral of the story, but some of the elements. And so we have this explanation of the parable. And as I read it, I can't help but think that they seem to have missed the main point, or the main thrust, the main elements of the story of the parable. Now, perhaps the parable was originally told to help explain the existence and persistence of evil in their community. Or if not evil, then the existence of disharmony and disagreement. Very likely, it was a way of speaking out against purges within the community, a way to try and stop attempts to get rid of those people that didn't fit in, those who didn't speak or think or worship correctly. It was a warning that weeding out people was a dangerous business, best left alone. But someone interpreting the parable heard the last bit, and perhaps wanting to make the point about accountability, to remind us that human behaviour is important and has consequences, chose to focus on the conclusion of the parable about what happens to the weeds eventually. They will throw them into the furnace of fire where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Don't you just love that phrase? Weeping and gnashing of teeth. This interpretation actually links quite well with some of the images of judgment in the preaching of John the Baptist that start the gospel, that come near the beginning of Matthew's gospel. Even now the axe is lying at the root of the trees, and every tree, therefore, that does not bear fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. One who is more powerful than I is coming after me. He will baptize you with Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will clear his threshing floor, and he will gather his wheat into the granary. But the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire. A few weeks ago, in the introduction to the reading, we were reminded that Jesus' preaching and ministry actually went on to vary from John's strong emphasis on the judgment to come. In fact, it varied so much that John sent out his disciples to check whether Jesus was in fact the one to come. Jesus did not come as the fiery judge, uprooting unfruitful trees or impostor weeds, but as one who offered God's compassion and forgiveness and announced the kingdom as a present reality, in which we are already in the presence of a God who is love. The pictures of judgment that John the Baptist declares and that Matthew brings us in the interpretation of the parable underlie much preaching of fear and threat, which describes a God who is vengeful and unforgiving. And somehow the parable then becomes not about letting the weeds and wheat grow together, but about how eventually they must be separated. Bill Loder writes, "A certain logic follows. It's a matter only of timing. God's love and compassion is only interim. Really, in the end, God will write people off, cease loving. He has to keep to the rules," becomes the rationale. And a God emerges for whom rules matter more than people. Where only the timing is a factor and love is only temporary, then Jesus becomes an exception to God's true nature, or at worst a ploy to appease him by taking our punishment. It's then not surprising that the timing is soon ignored, and people feel justified already in the present in acts of righteous indignation, in burning and writing people off. It is why Christians, feeding on these aspects of their tradition, have perpetuated terrible atrocities and abuses. and why we find Christians prepared to call for capital punishment and measures against fellow citizens which ignore possibilities for change. Root out the weeds. So a parable about the weeds growing together has suddenly become, in this interpretation, one that is about rooting out the weeds. The God in this parable interpretation, it seems, is a God whose compassion eventually runs out. But this is not the God we see in Jesus. This is not the God we see revealed in Jesus, nor is it the God of the psalm we heard in song at the beginning. And it is not the God who meets Jacob in his time of fear, his time of judgment. Jacob's waking reality, you might remember, is not a happy one. He has behaved badly. He has behaved very badly. And now he is in fear. Fear of his brother whom he has wronged. He is alone, separated from his family, an exile from his home. And it is in that place of judgment, that time of fear, that time in which he knows that he has done wrong, the time in which he feels most alone, that he lays down to sleep and he dreams. Jacob's dream is not a review of that shameful past. It is not accusations brought against him. But it is an invitation into an alternative future with God. Good news comes to Jacob in a time of despair. And the news is that he is not cut off from everything. The good news is there is connection between heaven and earth, between the divine reality and human life. Human beings are not left to their own resources, not left to travel alone with only the hope of survival. His life, even in this place, at this time, even in this situation, can be part of the divine reality, the divine vision. Jacob is not cut off from the sustaining role of God. Now, Jacob becomes aware of God's presence in a dream. But when he wakes, he doesn't say, "Oh, God was in that dream." He says, "God was in this place. God is in this place." He speaks of God's presence in his life, in the time and place of his waking reality. And while the promise that Jacob hears is similar to the promise that is made to the other patriarchs, the promise of land and many descendants, a promise of many blessings, it's also very specific to Jacob and his context. God is with Jacob in his time of threat, with him in his fear and in his loneliness. Now, Jacob pays attention to his dream, but he does not focus on it. He comes to learn to recognise God in his wakeful moments. The purpose of the dream has not been to keep him asleep, but to help him to recognise God in his wakefulness. Jacob's wakeful, attentive response to the promise he hears in a dream takes him deeper into a reality where the human and the holy are close companions. Jacob marks a place where he meets God in his dream. But not because he thinks God is only in his dreams or especially in that place. Jacob marks that place as a reminder of God's presence, in all of his life, in every place, in every circumstance. We meet here at Morialta on Sunday mornings at a time we have agreed on to worship, to know the presence of God and the company of others. We come here not because we think God is only in this place or at this time, or even especially at this place and time. We come so we can better learn to recognise God in all times, in all places, all circumstances. Coming together on Sunday mornings here in church gives some order to our lives, a time and a place for focusing on the divine reality and presence. On the divine reality and presence that is the setting for our lives every day, in every place. For it is true that we can and do meet God at other times, in the wonder and majesty of nature, in the beauty and challenge of artistic expression, in the hope and possibility of human relationships. Setting time aside to come here on Sundays does not diminish or deny that. What it does is gives us a time and place to declare to ourselves and to each other, God is with us. A time and a place to recognise and understand the point of all that has happened to us in the days and weeks that we have travelled through to get here. To know and acknowledge the ways that God has been with us. It gives us a place to recall the stories of our lives and to learn from them what is true and good and holy and what is not, so that we can let those go. It gives us a place to recall the stories of our lives so we can know ourselves to be blessed, even in the midst of things that threaten us, that make us want to run away in fear, even in the midst of things that make us feel ashamed or deeply regret the things we have done and said, even in our loneliness. It gives us time to pause and affirm again, God is with us, and God will be with us in all we have to face in the week to come. And like Jacob, it is a time that we can learn how we are blessed so we can be a blessing to others, so we can share the truth of a God who comes to us in every place, in every time, not to judge, but to call us more deeply into life. Coming together on Sunday to worship and declare God is with us is important. We know God is here, but let us not miss the point. God is here, but God is not only here. We come to remember, to know God is with us, so we can leave this place and declare that in every moment, in every circumstance, and in every place. God is with us.